Hello, and welcome to the 12th Bad Idea Podcast.
Yay, 1 year!
1 year of really fucking bad ideas. We are your hosts, Simon Abrams.
And I'm Steve Carlson. I just want to get this out of the way right now. Hammer-lemma-ding-dong, hammer-lemma-ding-dong.
Will you stop that?
I had to do it now, otherwise I would be thinking it through the entire podcast.
I'm still going to be thinking it throughout the entire podcast. Anyway, in case you're joining us for the first time, this is a podcast dedicated to, well, bad ideas.
Shitty movies.
We watch really bad movies, or we form a theme where if you were to watch these movies consecutively, it's like, hey, I know what we should do. We should, you know, like, it'd be the equivalent of saying, hey, I know, let's volunteer to, like, hit ourselves over the head with rubber mallets.
I think we, with this particular theme, I think we incurred a little more brain damage than usual.
Yeah, with this podcast, movies were often actually a lot more surreal than we imagined. But anyway, back to the introduction. The idea is that basically it's not just like, oh, we're stupid, we're going to watch bad movies, so that's part of it. The other part of it is that, you know, we're trying to see if there's anything worthwhile or just so strange or just, you know, unique that, like, can justify
these films' existence.
Yeah, basically. It's like dumpster diving, you know? Like, ooh, hey, this apple core is
particularly rotten, delicious.
And it's making me hallucinate, and I like it. My lips taste like gummy worms. That's the effect we're going for. And, so this month we wanted to do something special for you, our listeners, all three of you. And we decided to do a podcast dedicated to the movies of Happy Madison Production Studio.
The films we're covering are a little more well known than our usual fare, but
yes,
less painful.
We've gone mainstream, and it hurts.
Oh, good lord!
Yes, we basically I wanted there were so many uniquely rotten movies or just rotten movies to choose from. Like, I was even thinking of doing something like You Don't Mess with the Zohan, or blanking on a bunch of them. We were thinking of Little Nicky at one point. We were thinking of the Benchwarmers.
But Little Nicky's awesome.
No.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway. So we thought, and we were like, well, Steve had actually a pretty good idea, which is ironic considering this podcast.
Suggesting that Adam Sandler is engaging in a large scale producer's type scheme. Or are we? It's all the dudes who are like, oh, hey, there he is again. You know, not like David Spade and shit like that.
Norm McDonald.
Aside from Little Nicky.
Really?
Yeah. It was he basically got the first Friend of Sandler vehicle. So Deuce Bigelow 2, European Gigolo, is the, obviously a follow-up to that, attempt to recapture the magic, as it were.
Yeah.
Because Deuce Bigelow Male Gigolo is remembered fondly by children of all ages. And
here's the thing that kills me about some of these comedies, and it's pretty abundantly clear in European Gigolo, it's the idea that, like, these Happy Madison movies are, like, I think, like, trying to tap into veins of comedy that, like, other comedians, like Judd Apatow, Grandma's Boy is kind of like an Apatow comedy.
It's like an embryonic Apatow, yeah.
Yeah, there's like, there's stuff like that's where he's like trying to tap into the way there, but Apatow himself is actually influenced by Sandler. So like it's...
Well, yeah, and they were, I don't know if it's so much influenced because they came up in the same scene. Apatow and Sandler both, you know, helped create Undeclared. Sandler put on a performance on one of the episodes when the show was having ratings issues. Right. So,
but basically, in European Gigolo, I think is his way of like weirdly trying to get into the un-PC stuff that South Park guys do. In the sense that at least at the start, they're making a pointed effort to like say something offensive or semi-offensive about every type of person. There's like the one-legged black guy. Tries to steal the leg, that like prosthetic leg that belongs to Rob Schneider's wife.
Deceased wife.
We should say this up front. This movie is really weird. It has a part where like there's a woman with penis for a nose, and of course it gets wrecked several times. And like when she sneezes, she like comes on people's faces.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I would argue that Deuce Bigelow is actually one of the less weird films. I think it's actually, I think the problem is that it's fairly tame. And that's kind of a larger thing I'm noticing, not the tameness, but in that it's kind of using its dirty jokes as a kind of a juvenile, hey, look at me! When in its heart, it really doesn't want to be a dirty joke movie. It's like, it gets weirdly, like, sweet at the end. It turns into, like, this sort of sensitive new male type thing. Like to the point at the end where, you know, Deuce Bigelow is sword fighting with the villain. Sword fighting with penis swords, incidentally.
Yeah.
He's, you know, talking about how, oh, but gigolos aren't good for women because they don't respect them and, you know, no woman's looking for just sex and this, that, and the other thing, and won't somebody please blow me? I'm a really nice guy.
And I think that's where Apatow gets his influence from, is that, like, that moralizing impulse where it's fundamentally a movie that's about, like, well, why don't you become more mature than you actually know how to be, you stupid, the uneasy thing that I was trying to talk about is also stuff about, like, Eddie Griffin's character has a boat that's the of the sea, and it has hydraulics on it.
Yeah.
It's like a joke about how, like, oh, it's Mexico, they know what they're doing, there's a dumb American's joke with, like, American, where he's wearing, like, an American flag shirt. There's a joke in the sense of a woman where she's just, like, she's got huge breasts, and she's, like, rubbing them against the glass previously. I'm not sure if it's, like, a dumb blonde joke.
I think that was just a hey look boobs joke.
That could be. But the Asian joke with the Asian that has like a tiny penis.
Yes.
And his name is Wolf Kim.
Yes.
No way I take my 3 inches elsewhere.
Yeah.
There's several gay jokes.
There's tons of gay jokes. There's a rather disturbing amount of gay panic jokes.
There's a killer on the loose in this film. He's killing Andors or Gigolos. And this one guy's like, why are you going out to on the street? Basically, why are you working tonight? He's like, I'm suddenly gay. And he's like, really? He's like, yeah, who wants a blowjob? There's a guy at the other end of the room. He's like, actually, I would. And he's like, oh, well, then I better go put that penis in my mouth.
Actually laughed at not that particular bit, but in a bit I think that happens in the same scene where you know he's wondering why the guys aren't going out and being man whores as the film uses so often.
Yeah.
And one guy goes, "The dog ate my penis."
Yeah, I like that.
I did laugh at that. But the thing is, you know, you can say whatever you want about what the film's trying to do and what it actually does. And the at bottom is just this film is kind of desperately unfunny most of the time.
Sure.
It's
evil with Rob Schneider.
That's the thing. That's the thing. I actually kind of like Rob Schneider. I think I really like his. I have a kind of a weak fondness for his sort of deer, his schlummy deer in the headlights guy persona.
But that's the thing, like, he's kind of like Dustin Diamond tried to make Gene Wilder. He's not the most charismatic guy, he's not the most funny guy. He's just like a really good, being pathetic kind of guy.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. It's just, I just don't think this film really. It doesn't embrace what it wants to be. You know, it's holding itself back from its own modest ambitions. And like, compare that to something like The Hot Chick, which I think is I like that movie. I'm sorry, but it's weird. It's fucking weird, and it's proud of it. It is a movie that proudly has. What was it? It's like lesbian incest in it. And it's.
Hear that, fans? That's the first beer of the podcast. Go on, please.
It openly traffics in all this weird sort of sexuality. And it's really. I think it's really interesting and funny in certain ways. But this isn't. It's trying to be that, I guess, with, you know, all the women with dick noses and women with holes in throats. And
that's as close as I think we're going to get to, like, a live-action Muppet, dirty Muppet joke. And I think that, in that sense, like, there's just, like, there's stuff in that movie that, like, I feel like even though most of that film is, like, really bland, there's just, like, some stuff that just, like, are just randomly inserted because, you know, as is often the case with movies that we watch, they'll try anything once.
Yeah.
You know, like, the stuff with, like, Paul McDonald, which I was writing with you earlier about, I think Paul McDonald, like, really goes for it in that part, and, like, he's such a talented performer that, like, he takes what is just otherwise really threadbare and, like, could have been really easily unfunny joke that he's had to bust a guy with a funny Scotch accent, and he runs with it. I laughed. I thought he was good.
I laughed at the bracelet, and that was about it.
Yeah, there's a joke where there's a cock ring that he...
It's an electronic cock ring that is used to track people.
It's like, yeah, it's a GPS, like an Annie. His son, Will McDonald's son, is wearing it around as a bracelet, and he wants to try to get the son to take it off, and then he realizes it'll probably be, like, caused more trauma to the kid if he finds out what it actually is for. He's like, "Hey, you got a bracelet."
I think Mom's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was funny, yeah. But, and there, I mean, there's a couple things in there, like, that like, I got a chuckle off, like, the various bizarre names for fake sex acts. Like, there's something very appealingly amusing about Till Schweiger using all his German sleaziness to ask somebody if they want a Cambodian creamsicle.
I also really like where the Asian guy, Little Kim, is like, trying to get this one bouncer and, like, throwing him, like, just doing something so that, like, he'd be distracted long enough that Rob Schneider can sneak into, like, the building. And, he's constantly doubting this guy, saying, like, "Oh, your mother did this, your mother did that." And, like, the guy finally, like, digs in and, like, throws a little can into, like, a dumpster. And I love the punchline of the joke where, again, I think this is a more matter of, like, the comedian and, like, material here, or more transcending the shitty material, where he's like, "Hey, your mother's in here."
Yeah. I don't know. There's just so much in this film that is terrible, and it's because I don't think the film is really committed to its ickier material. It's a weirdly sexless movie for a movie about, you know, fucking.
It's the first two Spiegel being a lot more, you know,
yeah,
just being a lot more, like, in terms of its sex jokes.
And, well, the first two Spiegel also had the advantage of having Amy Poehler in it as the Tourette's syndrome patient. And she's pretty reliably funny no matter what you have her do. So, but it's is it's not committed to its dirtiness. And in fact, Deuce doesn't really have sex with any of the chicks in this. And that's kind of the point. Like, I haven't seen the original since, you know, God knows when. So I don't remember if it was the same in the first one.
The original is, it basically takes all the scenarios from the first one, as far as I recall, and it just rehashes them.
But in Europe.
In Europe, yeah. Like, the idea of, like, a really tall woman that wants to treat, like emasculated by having a baby, or is the,
There's the dick-nosed lady.
There's the woman with the Tourette's.
There's the woman with the hole in her throat.
And I think that's the thing, that's the reason why that segment of the film is, like, so marginalized, because they were like, well, we got to keep ourselves involved, interested and involved some way. So we are going to repeat ourselves because it's easy, but we're not going to, like, change things up enough to actually do something.
Yeah, it's...
Which is, you know, that's the Happy Madison work we love, right?
Kind of a blatant cash grab. And so I think that's a good one to start with, because it's pretty much the least interesting iteration of their ethos.
That's absolutely
good. If you want to move on, we do have that.
I'd rather move on.
Okay. We can go to Kevin James next. Speaking of uninteresting iterations of the Happy Madison ethos.
Yeah, and I think here's one of the times where, like, the plot line ended up how, like, James basically replaced the film with the shoes of Chris Farley is actually probably not far off the mark.
Probably not, except well, I...
And it's not, we, that goes back to the idea that, like, it's the performer here that matters, not the material.
Yeah.
Even with Chris Farley in Paul Blart Mall, I probably would have laughed my ass off.
I think Chris Farley would have been funnier, but also if Chris Farley had been a Paul Blart Mall Cop, it would have been an entirely different film.
Absolutely, that's
and that yeah. And I will admit this, I got a full on hate hard on for Paul Blart. I fucking despised this piece of shit, dishonest, grotesque, emotionally manipulative nonsense.
I don't think that was, like, most of that movie's just a one-note joke where it's like, oh, he's bad, laugh harder.
Right off the bat, it has the bit where he's, you know, like, comes home after failing the thing, failing the police academy.
And he has pie.
Yeah, but it's not that he's eating pie, it's that he's sitting there staring at the pie going, man, it will fill the cracks in my heart. Go away, pain. Yes, the peanut butter will go away, pain. We've been watching the film for 5 minutes, and already it's just drumming the patheticness of its protagonist into our head. Just like, this guy is so
simple.
It's just disgusting. I'm sorry.
That's typical. I mean, like, you just talk about Deuce Bigelow. We talk about a character in that film. Rob Schneider starts off, he's extra pathetic because he's like,
but we're not supposed to sympathize with him. He's just goofy. You know, I mean, and his wife died. His wife died under retarded circumstances. This film just pissed me off so much because it's like, it's trying to get you to sympathize with this guy. And then, like, doing that via making everyone in his life, except for Gina Mays, like, everyone that he encounters throughout the day, a horrible, horrible person who just can't see the worth in him. And it struck me as, I mean, I know, you know, the joke was that, you know, Observer Report is like, oh, it's the nasty version of Paul Blart. But now, having seen both of them, it feels more like, to me, like Jody Hill had the script for Observer Report.
Oh, definitely.
And like, Kevin James got a hold of it and was like, oh, I'd like to make this, but is there a way we can do this nicer?
Okay, that's fine. Okay.
But the ugly bits didn't come out all the way, so you still have shit like the N-word.
No, the ugly bits, that sounds vaguely
pornographic. the bit at the end where he, like, body slams a guy while wearing hockey, like, you know, like, wearing a hockey outfit or something.
I find this movie to be, like, too superficial to be, like, ever deeply offensive. Like, there's no little, there's, of the films we're talking about, I think this is the most vanilla. Like, you said Deuce Bigelow 2 was, but I think there's
nothing
in the Estrella is a woman with penis mass.
I do think Zookeeper's probably the most vanilla film that I watched.
But I think the idea of having Nick Nolte as a girl that's obsessed with TGI Fridays is much more surreal than anything you're going to see in Paul Blart Mall Cop. I mean, the idea of a fat guy being on the plane is almost so weird.
Yeah. It's, yeah, it's, I, say it's not weird, but it's, there's a lot going on in the film in terms of how it's using its emotional material. It just strikes me as ugly. It's like a real life version of Big Fat Liar. That's the one with Frankie Muniz, where Paul Giamatti plays the movie executive who jacks his story idea. I can't believe I just made a Big Fat Liar reference. Holy fuck. Wow. Anyway, to get back on track here, it's like what I have written down here. It's like, I think this occurred to me during the scene where like, you know, they're in the TGI Fridays type restaurant. Where Kevin James is like, oh, I can't drink. And then he starts drinking. It's just, I wrote, it's like, yeah, in Polar. It's like, it understands it should be angry with its empty plastic world, but passive aggressive complacency is so much easier. I'm not referring to the movie understanding it's how bad it is. I'm referring to inside the world of the film. It's like the character understands that he should be angry, but he can't work out.
So you're basically creating a medium where we don't have to read into any kind of authorial intentionality.
What? Gotcha!
What I'm saying is basically you're setting up a meaning that is clearly not intended by the film, but that just speaks to something that's like in the film that you feel is indicative of how equally stupid and unselfconscious it is. Right?
Okay, like, sure, whatever. Character is finally starting to step up to the plate, so to speak, and, you know, prove himself. It still takes every opportunity it can to debase him. Like the bit where he passes out in the computer room because he's hypoglycemic, and the only thing around is a lollipop on the floor that he can't shake, that he doesn't have enough energy to shake all the dirt off, so he has to eat it dirty.
Yeah, but again, I think if it were Farley doing that, because Farley's act was also entirely about, like, I'm fat, I hate myself. Self-image is lower than even yours. And I
but that's the thing, Farley.
I think your complaint seems to be that it's particularly sadistic in making fun of this character, no?
It's absolutely sadistic.
I don't think that's that unusual.
It takes every moment of triumph that he gets and undermines it.
I see why. Just having seen the same movie as you, yeah. I see why, but like...
It just struck me as particularly loathsome.
I think Zookeeper is worse just because
desperately loserly.
Getting love tips from zoo animals.
But they're cool zoo animals.
I know, by the way, it sounds like we're
yes,
going to get a stroke.
Hey, he pees on a wolf. It can't be all bad. No, I just think that zookeeper. I think zookeeper is less offensive simply because it hedges more bets.
No.
Yeah, I just did the last. It doesn't have the energy to offend.
It's the cliche guy get the girl at the last minute moment in Zookeeper is where Ken and James and Gorilla, voiced by Nick Nolte, are canoeing to intercept his girl on a bridge.
Yeah, that happened. Structure of Paul Blart kind of frustrates, you know, Kevin James. I don't know if you've ever seen Kevin James' stand-up.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he's, you know, despite the book, he's really animated, and he has a lot of energy, and he, you know, he channels it all out. Like, there's an aggressiveness there. And
the thing is, isn't that the case of all of these, like, unfunny comics, and how they came to comics?
Well, and Dan Cook's movies are irredeemable trash.
As opposed to Kevin and Jay.
But, well, that's what I'm getting to is that Zookeeper at least has a small outlet where he can, you know, start channeling some of that aggressiveness. And
I don't see it. I don't see it either.
Come on! The whole bit at the wedding where he's, you know, openly insulting the chick who dumped him. I didn't see Mr. Popper's Penguins, so. Why the fuck would I see Mr. Popper's Penguins? Because you're going to make me watch it for a podcast, I know. Oh, God. But, yeah, so. Anyway, I mean, yeah, James does seem to be kind of the in-house guy now for Madison to. When they need to make a. Well, they need a funny fat guy to make a kid's film, basically. But, you know, and you say that he's kind of a replacement for Farley. And Farley, again, had a lot more rage in his comedy, had a lot more aggressiveness. Yeah. It's like there was something more challenging there. And it's like, at least with Paul Blart, and to a lesser degree in Zookeeper, I'll admit it, but with Paul Blart, it's like he's deliberately crafted his character to tamp down all the interesting things.
Yeah, I think the closest we have to a Farley character now is that Alf Mathis. And, like, because his shtick, he's the comedian whose self-loathing in his stand-up has translated the closest to his actual, like, mainstream stuff. Like, we have the Oscars where he's like, I'm Zach Efron, where he misses the can't pronounce his last name.
I'd say the closest we have to, unfortunately, the closest we have to Farley right now would be Artie Lang. Well, no, but I just mean in terms of, you know, if you're going to talk comic personas.
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, like, just in terms of the transition from one state to the other, I think.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I see where you're going with that.
Yeah. Artie Lang as there is on the back of the
Alphabet. Yeah, I see where you're going with that. But yeah, so.
What's next?
Now we start getting into some of the darker waters. Because you know, not everybody in the Madison stable has you know, safe, easy senses of humor. And one of those guys is one of his go-to cameo guys, Alan Covert. going to Grand Hospital.
Yeah, we're doing Grand Hospital.
I like Grand Hospital. I'm still kind of mixed on it, but I did actually watch it twice for this podcast because I love you people and I'm devoted to you and I want you to have the best podcast you can. Yeah. The first time I watched it, I was totally sober. The second time I watched it, I came home from a separation. Started drinking heavily at 12:45 at night just so I could get into a state where I felt I might be able to appreciate it because I don't smoke pot. So there's a lot of the fun kind of went over my head. The second time around, I was drunk enough, but, you know, still conscious enough to realize that, you know, the first time through, I was like, I feel like I'm watching something in a language that doesn't have subtitles. The second time through, I realized that's actually not my fault. It's the film's fault. The film actually doesn't get on its own wavelength until, like, the third act. I think the first hour is pretty dead. I mean, there's straight laughs here and there. I mean, the film doesn't really, you know, break open until. Rejoice! Yeah. Anyway, so we're talking about Grandma's Boy and its structure, and the funny thing is, I understand what you're getting at. I think it's actually. It's kind of reflective of the character, and it's, you know, interesting that it's a stoner comedy about a guy who, you know, tests video games for a living. You know, this could be accused of being immature. There's a lot of jokes about maturity in the film's first few 20 minutes or so. You have Nick Swardson wearing footy pajamas and sleeping in a race car bed. But here's the thing. Yeah, okay, he's an immature stoner, but he still makes good money. He's responsible. He gets his job done properly, and you know, once his work is done, then he goes out and parties.
Well, it's the same joke that Apatow crew has been making for a while now.
It's kind of a fundamentally conservative joke, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why, like, I found this movie to be charming because, like, as I was saying, my roommate Zach Nico, the idea that, like, you're dealing with. It's well, actually not worse. It's just basically that, like, that Sandler movies are that much more immature. That, like, when these characters try to impress you with their maturity, like, it only is funny because, like, these guys clearly can't even bring themselves to pass. They can't do it.
Yeah.
They can't even put up a straight face for that long.
I also think that the, you know, having Linda Cardellini here helps. She's the blonde. The video game tester lady. I think she's really charming in the film, and so yeah, there's that. But the film does have a lot of really funky, weird, sidelong things, like, you know, the dude with the dealer who has a kung fu monkey.
Yeah,
that's right, monkey, play my head. that Spiegel, I can tell you, dumpster joke, penis face.
Well, it's because you only laughed like three or four times, that's why.
Or the North Top joke. Yeah. And, like, in those cases, they were like, again, it goes back to the, what I think is probably, admittedly, like a fast out reading, but, like, in this and Madison canon, a lot of times what's actually really gut busting and funny is what's really just weird and out there.
Oh, yeah, I've been saying that for years, and that's actually one of the reasons I like Little Nicky a lot. And that Little Nicky is
probably the most consistent and weird.
It's unbelievably fucking weird.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I mean, Henry Winkler is attacked by bees at the end. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny stuff. And yeah, I think that the Madison films do become most interesting when they just give in to their weirdest impulses.
I remember off the top now, one of my favorite moments in Grandma's Boy is there's an old woman that's having sex with one of the main characters. Is it Nick Swartz?
It's Nick Swartz's character having sex with Florence Henderson.
Yes, Florence Henderson knows. And I love the image where she's punning on the idea that she's old, like really old.
Yeah.
And, like, she says, like, I once gave Charlie Chaplin a
I was just about to cite that.
And it doesn't need the punchline this has. It could have just stopped with
saying,
that was he silent?
Yes.
It's just funny.
Yes, that's why it's funny. It's not the Charlie Chaplin, I gave him a handjob line. It's Swartzen's just off the cuff reaction, like, was he silent?
Has like an overburdened punchline after that, where it's like, not after I was done with him, which is not nearly as funny as words you're like, that's silent.
But yeah, I mean, and the film has a lot of little asides like that, where it takes a joke and just tweaks it, you know, just weird enough that it's funky, like, you know, like the bit with one of Jonah Hill's first roles, where, you know, baby wants some milk. Like, he's at this party, and this chick has these enormous fake boobs.
Who looks like the fattest that he ever was.
Yeah, I don't think Jonah Hill was ever fatter than this.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so he's like, baby wants some milk? And then, you know, it's like, of course, yes. And the joke continues later in the film, because it keeps cutting back to him, and he's still there sucking on a boobie. Yes, even after the party's over, he's standing next to the doorway of Grandma's house. And he's still there, and she's just eating cereal. But, you know, so it does have a certain sort of dedication to making the joke as weird as possible, which I fully support.
Well, that's the thing, because now we're getting into the stuff where Sandler has Nick Swartzen in his crew. And Swartzen, as you can see in his TV show, is a weird dude.
Yeah.
And not always necessarily in a funny way, but, like, as we'll see in Bucky Larson, in a really weird, why do you think, like, taking this joke as far as you're taking it is funny necessarily for anyone other than you? And, you know, there isn't really a good answer.
But then again, does there need to be? I mean, you know.
Well,
yeah. Well, I mean, if you're Nick Swartzen, yes. I mean, if you're Andy Kaufman, no. But, you know, Nick Swartzen isn't Andy Kaufman.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not that devoted.
He's not an outside artist. He's, you know, a guy that's making Happy Madison movies.
Yeah.
And it's not like the equivalent of, like, Happy Madison.
Yeah. And I will say this, that of all the films we covered, I think Grandma's Boy is the one, because I mentioned earlier about these films all trying to be one thing and hiding what they really want to be, and then only letting it come out, you know, like in little drips and drabs. And I do think Grandma's Boy is kind of the exception to that, because it's basically the film it wants to be from frame one. It's like, yeah, whatever. I'm a goofy immature stoner comedy. Stop right there. So, you know, but I do think, and just getting back to that, I do think we're coming up on the film whose intentions and execution could not be clashing more than any other film we're talking about. Bucky Larson, Bucky Larson, Born to Be a Star, whose subject matter and execution, and specifically tonal execution, is just, it's such a weird combination that the film, I can't say the film's funny. It has a couple of lines in it where I was like, oh, okay, I laughed at that. But yeah, mostly it's just deltifyingly weird. Like, mesmerizingly weird.
Yeah. I have a page of notes here, and most of my notes consist on variations of what? Because that's really the only way to react to this fucking movie.
Yeah, it's a really, like, just oh my god, this movie. It's just so, I don't know, man.
It's terrible, but in a sort of, in a really unique way.
I just realized, by the way, a moment ago, why my voice isn't as carrying as well as you are on this new microphone that we're using. Well, maybe it's just because of my voice, never mind. Anyway, keep talking.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just loud and obnoxious.
Well, I fit one of those two categories.
But, yeah, no, so, I mean, Bucky Larson is a movie about a kid with Prince Valiant hair and buck teeth, and who finds out a tiny, tiny penis, as we're told over and over again.
Yeah.
And also an enormous pubic bush.
Very big.
Yes. And he looks like he's he looks like he's filleting a Wookiee, basically. And or a Wookiee's filleting him, I should say.
Yeah.
He goes out to Hollywood to be a porn star because he found out his parents were porn stars in the '70s, like legendary porn stars. Apparently legendary for being completely wholesome and nice while having sex.
It seemed like the mom and pop were porn.
Yeah, it's so... And they've raised this kid who's totally sincere and totally naive and
He knows nothing about sex. Like, this movie starts with the premise that he's never masturbated before in his life. How old is he supposed to be?
I don't think it ever actually mentions how old he is. But he's old enough to be in the workforce.
Yeah.
But then he also says he never went to high school.
Okay.
Because his town doesn't have one.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Wait, hold on. This kid, cement the idea that he's like a total sexual, like, nothing. His friends, like, invite him over to watch a farm. This is how he finds out that his parents are porn stars. Because the porn stars and the farm are his parents. And his friends are, like, making fun of him. And they have him, like, drop his pants and, like, humiliate himself by, like, wildly, like, jerking off his penis.
Am I a whacker?
Yeah. And, like, he does that, and it's, like, it's a joke that we'll go on to later where, like, he's actually auditioning to try to be in porn films where he tries to masturbate and, like, he's just, like, he pulls his pants down at, like, a macaroni and cheese and, like,
useful advice for life, incidentally. Don't pull your dick out at a mac and cheese commercial.
Don't listen to your inner violin. Don't do it. Just don't do it.
Oh, my God.
What?
Really? Violin?
I have to record Evan in every podcast I do. It's in my contract.
See,
I'm
thinking more along the lines of violin and crank high voltage.
Oh, she did that then, too? She took her dick out?
No. She might have had a dick in that movie, though. I don't know.
Get your dick out. Sorry. So, where were we before I talked about
We were talking about Bucky Larson taking his dick out in a macaroni and cheese.
Yeah. So, that situation could conceivably...
My mom is so proud of me, incidentally, that I'm sitting there saying we were talking about Bucky Larson pulling out his dick in a macaroni and cheese.
Hi, please, Mom. So, the point is that, like, if I were to describe Bucky Larson to you, scene by scene, you probably think this movie's hilarious, or at least so weird that you have to see it, which the latter is true, but
yeah, it's
because it's so, like, presumably so weird that it will, like, do something for you, and hopefully it will, but, like, funny isn't one of them.
No, it's just sort of off, and I think it took me pretty much the entire film to figure out why, but it's because, the character of Bucky Larson is just so guileless and you're very stereotypically quote unquote Midwestern, and he takes everything at face value. And here's the thing: the film does too.
Yeah,
the film isn't making fun of him. I mean, it pretty much genuinely likes him.
Yeah,
and it wants him to succeed.
The sarcastic register of this movie is so high that, like, I think it actually loops back to sincerity.
Yeah,
which is what's so weird, because, like, this is a movie where, like, Bucky Larson becomes a porn star, but only, like, the anti-porn star. Like, he has a tiny penis, and, like...
And shoots jism uncontrollably.
Whenever he just sees nudity.
Yeah, you know, when he sees a boobie, yeah.
He just, like, scatterguns everyone, and it gets everywhere except for, like, the girl. And, like, yeah. People see these videos of him, and they go crazy, and they think, oh, wow, this guy actually makes my boyfriend look good, or, oh, wow, this guy actually makes me look good. Yeah. Thank you, Bucky Larson.
For being so pathetic that you've made my self-esteem better.
Yeah, and that's, like, God.
Yeah. But and you have that alongside, you know, Christina Ricci acting her little heart out as someone who literally wants to be the best waitress she can be.
Yeah, that's an aspiration to be able to, like, hold a tray of, like, food and not spill it.
Yeah, and it's like, her and Bucky are, you know, they get along and they eventually become boyfriend and girlfriend, and it's just treated really sincerely. And it's like you spend the entire film waiting for the shoe to drop, and you realize, no, this is actually sincere.
Yeah, I kept waiting for Lars von Trier to come out of the thing. Just like,
it's just this really sort of cognitively dissonant experience where it's some kind of question if they were even really trying to make a comedy, or if it started as a comedy and then became a character piece or something.
I think honestly, like, if Paul Rubens ever had the chance to, like, if the whole, you know, masturbating public thing didn't happen, he would have had the opportunity to make a movie like this, and, like, if his career had been allowed to go on, and, like, he probably would have been able to just, like, make at least two more of these before someone was like, dude, what the fuck are you doing? But, like, it seems like the kind of thing that, like, someone that, like, totally was trying to impress people with how, like, id crazy they are could make if they had the money. Okay. And, you know, because Nick Swartzen is friends with Adam Sandler, a guy that rewards his friends for doing well, like, his version of a bonus is giving them Ferraris.
Yeah. He would give you a movie. Yeah.
Yeah, he'd give you a film.
And I would just like to point out that I actually watched the film all the way through the credits for some reason. The first one.
The Avengers?
Yes. Wow, I didn't see that coming.
What, really?
It's really.
How?
But no. Because I wasn't thinking that. But at the end, there's, you know, how it has, like, the little copyright thing. The copyright date on this is 2010. That means Sony got this film, or Columbia, whoever released it, and stuck it on a shelf for a year while they went, what the fuck do we do with this? And when you see the film, you can understand why. It's like, this is a film not made with any audience in mind.
It's an ash can film.
It's a total UFO. It's the kind of film that if it had come out in the 70s, it would have been released in, like, one drive-in in the South.
Yeah,
and people would be talking about it today like it was the Cuckoo Clocks of Death or something. Yes, the Cuckoo Birds, that's the film. It would be one of those legendary lost films where people who had seen it would be like, I was there, man. You don't know.
It's like the film Cigarette Burns.
Yes. And you know what? After it was over, I kind of felt like threading my guts through a projector. Just because it seemed like the only rational thing to do.
Shout out to Drew McQueen.
I liked your film, Drew. Just so you know.
I didn't. Sorry.
I wasn't crazy about Pro Life.
I like the movie that John Carpenter was making, not the one that you were. Okay, now I'm joking. I just didn't like it. Sorry.
I didn't like Pro Life.
I didn't see Pro Life.
It's not very good, in my opinion. I don't know. I don't know why we're talking to Drew McQueen. He's never going to listen to this.
I'm going to drive. See you can.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Is there a last for you?
No, I'm just going to good luck with that.
Good luck with Ken?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Thanks.
That'll be fun.
Right. Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
Woo! All right. So let's move on to
Dance Dance Revolution, our last. Oh, no, but we can't leave Bucky Larson without at least giving props to fucking Don Johnson.
You give props to Don Johnson?
No, because he's in this playing a down-and-out porn producer, and there was something very appealing about his... Is very seedy desperateness.
Yeah.
Like a worn-out hustler who finds a chance for one more big score. You know, sort of a cliched role, but Johnson really gives his all to it. Like, he really believes in it.
Yeah. He's like, in every one of these movies, there's one guy that's, like, clearly going above and beyond what the material called for.
Well, you have Ricci in this, too, doing the exact same thing.
I think Johnson's more impressive. Ricci,
well, I do think Johnson's more impressive.
I think Ricci could easily coast on that same act that she's been doing for the last couple of years.
The concerned wall-eyed cutie doll?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what
wait, Christina Ricci, if you're listening, you can do that cute act for me anytime, baby.
You people!
You people, how?
And that's what's weird about this movie. Like, everyone in the film is just treating it at this level.
Well, you guys realize we just made an afterlife reference, right? Look it up. After period life.
No, don't look it up. It's terrible.
Look it up.
No, it's terrible.
Look it up.
It's not even worth the reaching nudity.
Don't look it up.
There's reaching nudity everywhere, and it's not worth it.
Liam Neeson.
It's terrible.
Nudity.
Liam Neeson's nude in that? I don't remember that.
Deleted scenes.
Oh, God.
I'm making this up as well.
Anyway, no, there's a certain sincerity like, to everyone in the film. Even Stephen Dorff is playing it essentially straight as the sleazy, you know, rival to it.
He's like a weird mirror of who he'll play in somewhere.
And it's just, that's what makes it so weird, in that it's played really straight.
Which is, you know,
I think
we're funny.
Yeah, exactly.
I encourage it.
I'm down with that. I'm one of the biggest fans of Freddy Got Fingered you're ever going to see. Speaking of another, you know, a UFO movie that ruined its maker's career.
You're going to make them watch that for a podcast, aren't you?
You've never seen it?
I have. I remember sneaking into it, but I don't remember much more than that.
Okay.
I remember I snuck into it when I was like...
No, I wouldn't make you watch that because I don't think Freddy Got Fingered is a bad idea. I think that movie's an amazing idea. Anyway, now that we've lost our remaining listeners... Let's
take a pants off.
Yes. Oh my God, you look like Bucky Larson! But, so yeah.
My wish is nothing.
Thank God. Looked like he was trying to choke out Cher.
It looked like that bit from that Anna Faris bit with Puppy.
Yes.
It's scary.
Oops, haven't trimmed down there in a while.
Wow, you actually just quoted.
I've seen Scary Movie a couple times.
So have I, but... Damn.
I really like Anna Faris. Ow! Fuck!
Come on, bitch!
That was the universe punishing me for actually knowing a line from Scary Movie. Oh my God.
That was actually pretty funny, but yeah. I'll have to be there to watch the art of his elbow.
But, so anyway, I guess now we get to the grand finale. It's like, yeah, okay, Happy Madison. It's mainly the friends of Sandler, but, you know, Sandler still does his own
Sandler
stuff.
Sandler is his own best friend.
Sandler is his own best friend, and he still puts his movies out under his own production company.
Because that's the thing, there's like a really, because those of you who know Jack and Jill or know of it, you know that it's a movie where Adam Sandler does drag and he plays his own sister. And there's like a point where, like, this movie is schizophrenic, like, self-loathing or joking. Because that's the thing, it's a kind of jokey, not quite serious self-loathing that, like, someone like Armand White confuses for actual, like, yeah, you know, like...
It's not like Funny People where, you know, Sandler has that line about how, you know, like, he wants on his grave, you know, don't come fucking visit me, you motherfuckers, and something like that, however the line goes, but...
Yeah, this is a movie that, like, tries to show you that, like, it's constantly trying to impress you with the idea that, it's like, it's basically like a Tyler Perry movie for Jews, like the idea that, like, if you're not in tune with your Jewishness, or if you're not basically like a caricature of Jewishness, and you're not stale in the Bronx, or like if you're in the cases where they make reference to Jared from Subway, if you're not still the fat guy, and you're not comfortable being the fat guy, or comfortable being the stereotype, then you're somehow selling out. And let me just tell you, I normally refrain from vocally disagreeing with Armand, because I worked with him for 2.5 years, but his praise of this movie as being, like, charming for, like, talking about the idea of Jewish self-loathing, fuck you. Fuck you. That is the biggest pile of bullshit, and the fact that you willingly eat up what Adam Sandler shat out onto the screen, fuck you. Because you think you know what you're talking about in terms of Jewish self-loathing and representations of Jewishness, and you don't. You're just basically accepting what this guy is putting on the screen as at face value. And frankly, it shouldn't be. It's the kind of disingenuous bullshit that should be, you know, the first thing to reek of, not facetiousness, but of total disingenuousness, total... Oh, it's fake. It's totally fake.
It's
and the one thing that
it's essentially a Jewish blackface act.
Yes. it's minstrelly. I mean, that's the thing. Like, and it's approaching that point of, like, the only point where I felt like that kind of stereotypes is the truest form of, like, being true to your roots, that kind of bullshit double talk, the only time where it almost, like, got so much crap, basically, was the point where Adam Sandler's character is dressing up within the film as his sister to try to get Al Pacino to do a commercial for his ad agency. And because Al Pacino has the hots for Adam Sandler's sister, who in the movie is played by Adam Sandler. And, like, there's a scene where you see Adam Sandler as his character dress up as his sister, and there's a part where Adam Sandler is defending his character dressed up as his sister to Al Pacino, who's like, oh, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He's so pathetic.
He's a hack.
Yeah, and, like, he lets Pacino go on a little bit long enough to basically reveal that, like, there is a moment of almost genuine self-loathing. But it's starting by the fact that, wait a minute, no, it's going to continue to, like, the scene's going to climax with Pacino saying, you know, like, you know what I see when I see you? I see someone that's not in the spotlight. And it brings it back to, like, the plot. And it just shows you that, like, this supposedly real self-loathing that this film, like, makes a big show of, like, how much Tyler Perry makes a big show of, like, the idea that, like, blackness equals, like, realness, like, stereotypes of these pen caricatures of race equal, like, hyper-reality. That is utter crap. I will say unequivocally that it's shit. And I'm sorry, but I have to have a meltdown about this because Jack and Jill, the movie we just saw, is awful.
It's shit.
And it's awful for reasons that critics probably didn't go into, but yeah, it's offensive. This movie I just saw, it offended me.
It's a piece of shit. And even beyond that, it's just the laziest fucking hack work nonsense bullshit. It's the
nonsense that is funny, like the Shaquille O'Neal cameo.
Yeah, there's one funny part in the film, and it's on YouTube if you care to look it up. Look up Shaq, Jack, and Joe.
They will die laughing.
Have another ding dong. That is fucking amazing. If the entire movie had been constructed out of that, I would have shit gold and called it a masterpiece. But here's the joke in which I didn't take a whole lot. I took exactly 4 minutes for this. And the point in which I gave up taking notes was when Norm Macdonald shows up, given absolutely nothing to do as one of Jill's blind dates.
Yeah, he's got way more to do in these big out too.
And he's got more to do in the animal, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. Oh my god, he is in the animal.
And he's funny in the animal. I liked him.
Okay.
But the joke is that that Norm Macdonald's character had advertised himself online as a fun bucket. And this is literally Sandler's line. I was thinking of someone more fun or buckety. Like, you're not even fucking trying! Someone, you wrote that! You wrote that down!
Yeah, I remember I made a remark that, like, the ridiculous part about this movie is that there were a lot, like, the scene where Al Pacino has, like, a meltdown during Russian Bed. So, like, somebody, like, wrote Al Pacino's lines for this scene. The scene wasn't ad-libbed. It wasn't made up on the spot. Someone committed this to paper. That paper was printed out. It was handed out to a casting crew that were being paid money to make this movie.
One of them is Al goddamn Pacino!
And for fuck's sake, like, I understand that a movie, like, you can give me the solipsistic answer of, like, oh, well, it's a movie. It doesn't need to be Shakespeare all the time. But, like, it's got to be funny. Or it's got to
be competent.
It's got to have a modicum of competence that, like, makes me want to take you seriously. And when a movie like this makes a big show of its moralism and its sense of bullshit, I could like, totally disavow what I'm seeing in a moment just by scrutinizing you for a moment, for a second.
In a supposedly spontaneous act caught on YouTube.
Yeah. It's shit. This movie is...
It's the lowest of the low.
Like, when people joke that, like, oh, well, the Razzies are, like, how originally before saying this, like, oh, the Razzies are just basically picking soft targets when they choose movies like Breaking Dawn and Jack and Jill to, like, pick on. No.
Yeah, Jack and Jill deserves. Jack and Jill deserves. Yeah. It's like, I honestly didn't think I was going to see a worse film from last year than Cat Run. But. And Cat Run, incidentally, is a film made so incompetently that it's not even in focus for a good portion of the film.
Jack and Jill just.
It's vile. It was just stupid and unfunny and just desperate and just sat there reeking of flop sweat. It's pretty loathsome, people. And what does that say when we watch something like Bucky Larson and go, oh, that actually wasn't that bad?
We question the ethics of a movie, you know? Yeah. Like, we're guys that watch exploitation movies,
yeah,
knowing that, like, these movies are more, like, honest about what they're achieving, and they're playing more fair with their audience than anything Jack and Jill ever did.
Yeah, a lot of the films we watch are admittedly pretty morally wretched, but they're upfront about it.
Yeah, they're not trying to hide the fact that, you know, we came to see, we're giving you what we think you want, we're pandering to you,
yeah,
and that's our objective here.
Yeah.
This movie panders and tries to hide its pandering behind this kind of
family values.
It's utter crap.
Yeah, it's tough. So,
can you move on, please?
In conclusion, thanks for nothing, Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
Some of your friends are funny, though.
Yeah.
I do have to admit that I think I laughed twice during this movie, and I think one of them was an Alan Covert line. So
your bird flew into my sandwich.
Your bird flew between my bread.
Yeah.
So Alan Covert, I will buy you a beer if you're ever in town for being the only funny guy in
Jack
and Jill.
What? No.
And also
Jack, if you're ever in town, look us up, guys.
We'll buy you a beer.
We'll buy you a ham.
The Hamalama Ding Dong scene three or four times.
Jack, we love you.
But, yeah, so anyway, we've actually gone on an hour already about Happy Madison, so we should probably cut that off and get to the.
Now is the part of our show where we talk, we do this segment called the Netflix Grab Bag. Netflix Grab Bag is a portion of our show where we talk about, or we basically, we all try and get you much between my Netflix queue, either the instant or DVD. And Steve's, and we basically,
just keep going.
Thanks, and we basically take four random numbers, and we, if it's a film that neither of us have seen, we toss it up there, and we have you, gentle, kind, sweet listeners, vote for the film that you want us to talk about. And this month, we had a couple of really good options. We had
a Blame.
Sorry, microphone did that again. Anyway, we had Blame, the movie
Spanish, by... Cerrador.
The guy who did Who Could Kill a Child.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that he was still around and doing stuff. But we also had a bunch of other stuff by...
we had a La Chinoise.
La Chinoise, yes, the Godard
film, which got a couple votes. And we had one other thing that didn't get any votes, which I forgot what it was.
Anyway, but the film that we chose and we went with is, actually, hold on, I test the audio because we're not sure. Our microphone's fucked up. Sorry, our technical difficulties in this episode overflow.
We're apparently having issues today. I don't understand, but whatever. Anyway.
So, yeah,
the film that ended up winning was
Happy Chop Punk, We Are Stickles, Blissfully Yours. A 2002 feature that actually was one of the first times where Joe made a splash at Cannes, apparently.
Yeah, I think it was his breakthrough work, because I mean, he'd done Mysterious Object and Noon and a couple of short films. But yeah, Blissfully Yours was the first one where people were like, whoa, who's this guy?
Yeah, and I have to admit, I love many of the short films that I've seen by Joe, including Worldly Desires, and I think Drop the Maladies is masterpiece.
That's a pretty great fucking movie, yeah.
Syndromes and Centuries, Uncle Boomy, who can recall his past lives. These are really terrific movies, and I thought Blissful thought, I made a stupid joke when we were watching it, that it's like the artiest nudist camp film ever, and, you know, unfortunately it's kind of true, because, like, nudist camp movies were films where, like, they, at least if you were to take the supposed intended ethos of those movies seriously, it's about, like, the beauty of nature, and fawning and sunning, and a lot of Blissfully Yours is about, like, a very abstract, non-linear narrative about, like, four characters having sex in the woods, and it's basically the most therapeutic thing that they could do. Their moods change wildly from scene to scene, but, like, it's all, like, for the sake of, like, getting in touch with themselves, and, you know, getting in touch with each other's bodies, and, like, it's, as in all of Joe's movies, sex is not sensationalized at all. It's an erotic thing. It's a strange thing. It's a thing that characters just do. It's a perfectly natural thing.
And that's the key. And why do they do it? Because fucking is fun, you know?
Yeah, there's a woman that's, like, erotically caressing her lover's side. Like, I felt that she was about to perform a psychic surgery. And there's another one where a woman is, like, she's fondling with gusto this guy's uncircumcised penis.
There's a guy that just landed in Riverside. She's like, oh, yeah, there it is. Blah, blah, blah.
And, yeah, she's touching it for, you know, in real time, and it's like, I guess I'd be lying if I said I wasn't being uncomfortable by it, but, like, it's, you know, that's the kind of movie you're looking at, because, like, while I could appreciate that this is very much of a piece with Joe's films, and I actually, on the whole, even though, like, that experience of watching the movie was a bit grinding and excruciating, like, I thought it was all right.
Yeah,
I can't get worked up about it either way.
Yeah, I'm down with it. I think it's a perfectly good film. I really enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed the atmosphere of it, and the whole idea of, you know, using nature as kind of a getaway to me. It's set up in the beginning that all these people are, you know, undergoing various torments, whether they be physical or otherwise.
Yes, one of the most striking things about this movie is that it, like, for a good 45 minutes, you're setting up the characters in the very slow real-time style that Joe has perfected. And then the movie only really starts once the credits come in, and that's about the 45-minute mark.
Yeah.
And, like,
as they're driving away from civilization into the forest.
They're confused because, like, are these credits the end credits? No, they're the beginning credits.
Now the movie truly begins.
Yeah. And, like, I made a really nerdy reference to Steve. I was like, you know, if these sequences were, like, serial issues of a story, like, of a comic, everything up until that credit sequence would be issue zero. It'd be like, you know, the freebie thing that they try to get to hook people to understand. Like, well, here's where you stand when you start issue one.
This is the world.
Yeah, and, like, so you could easily excise it if you wanted to. But looking back on the film, I found it to be the most interesting because it's the part where Joe takes the most time to set up the world. And I think he's a very interesting guy because, like, in the scenes where he creates worlds from these very static scenes are actually really fascinating. And they're surreal scenes because they're the most mundane moments. They're, like, you know...
Well, yeah, it's like, I know Kent Beeson has long held that he thinks the first half of Tropical Malady, even though it's set in the ostensibly real world, is actually more surreal to him than the second half.
I think that's there's a lot of truth to that. Yeah. I think there's a lot of truth to the idea that, like, Joe's most strange stuff is often, like, I mean, he tries to make mundane what's inherently surreal, like in Uncle Boomy, where, you know, there's a monkey ghost at the table,
yeah.
And he's got big red eyes, and he's just sitting there, and he's talking to the characters like nothing is weird, and, you know, that's kind of all the piece of Joe's films, too, but the idea that, like, it cuts both ways, and that, like, a scene at the doctor's office where an old man and his daughter are, like, arguing about, like, is he related? That was fucking weird.
And all the more weird for not really having anything to do with the narrative.
Well, that's the thing. Like,
it's just a random bit of life dropped into the middle of the film.
It's all character building. It's all world building. And that's what I like about that sequence, because it's got, like, that sense spite of, yes, I've read Armand's reviews and or attempts at reviewing Umi, and he made a point of saying that he thinks that it's like pseudo spiritual and bloody. No. This is the real thing.
It's pseudo spiritual because it's not Christian.
It should be obvious, but one is made by a real artist, and one is not.
And one is made by a hack.
Yeah, one is hack. Yeah, that hack is Adam Sandler.
Unless you get confused. Right, and you know, pursuant to what you were saying there, it's interesting that you know a lot of the most memorable moments in Joe's films tend to be like in Uncle Boomy, the part with the catfish, or you know the ghost monkey sitting at the table. But the point is, that he does take care to keep these from just seeming like you know, surrealistic asides. Like, you know, he builds the kind of world where this stuff can happen.
You realize this is going to be remembered as a podcast where I quote that
on the plate? Sure, go for it.
All right. Fair enough.
What's wrong with that? but yeah, it's not just cheap exoticism. It's not, you know, like, oh, you know what would be interesting to have in this? You know, a scene where, you know, where a girl's blowing a dude by a river. It's like, no, he takes time to, you know, work everything into a fabric.
Right. There is and I guess that's what I was trying to get at. There is a world here. Yeah. There is a milieu that is more than just, you know, contextless mysticism.
Yeah.
You can go away from a movie like Uncle Boomy or Blissful Yours and not totally understand how each symbol relates to each other, because they are impenetrable at your point, but you'll be able to understand what that impenetrability means with relation to one scene to the next.
It's not free floating, you know, just random weirdness.
It's not Joe plumbing his headspace for all his subconscious thoughts. It's actually a pretty fascinating look at like a dream of how life could be for these characters.
Yeah, it's I did really enjoy this one more than I expected to, honestly.
Really?
Yeah. Because I like Joe, but it's like for me, Joe tends to work in like two registers. Like I either really really love his film, or I'm like, oh, okay. And just kind of, you know, have a bit of an aloof admiration for. Like, for me, like, the latter category, you have Syndrome of the Century and Mysterious Object of Doom. And in the former category, you have Uncle Boomy and Tropical Malady. I have to admit, I was kind of expecting Blissful Yours to be one of the films I was more remote towards. But
I
ended up really getting involved in it. I mean, even as I was aware that, boy, the film's really taking its time, there was still something very seductive about it. Even as I was aware of the slow process, I was like, I didn't care. Because it was just like I could have stepped into that screen and spent time among these people, and I would have been fucking, you know, happy as hell. Like, I'll go walk in that fucking river. Hell yeah!
Yeah. it's got a very inviting quality to it that, it tries to set up, and that's what it's going for. But I think he achieves that kind of ambiance and atmosphere that is, you know, it's an unreal task, because that's all the movie has to offer, and if you can't deliver, you're fucked.
Yeah.
And he does it. I think he's nothing if not a very talented purveyor of, you know, a specific kind of world and a specific kind of narrative that no other person has really delivered. And I think more than any kind of exoticism, that's what people respond to. It's like that vision of life that is so unique to Joe.
Yeah.
And that we sort of associate more than like, oh, you see some David Lynch influences here and there.
There's a sort of movie. there's a sort of optimism in it without being, you know, open, like, utopian, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, what I was going to say is, but I didn't want to interrupt, that this would be the space where we would normally throw out the choices for the new Netflix grab bag. But it just occurred to me, we don't have to do that.
Right.
Because our next podcast is actually going to be a bit of a break from routine.
Yes.
We're going down to the 12-hour Exhumed Fest in Philadelphia.
Woo!
And we are going to podcast about that after that's over.
Yes, and it'll be a first for us because our topic will be, you know, like an event. We'll be covering an event for you guys. And another first for us, apart from that, because we're reviewing, what is it, like, how many films?
I believe they're playing seven films.
So, yeah, the podcast will be dedicated to that, but it'll be a new experience also because it will be the first podcast to feature a guest speaker.
We will have a guest speaker with us.
Yes, it will be, some of you know him on Twitter as Paper Lung, yeah. But it will be, it's Philadelphia,
Philadelphia Weekly.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, okay, Matt Perget, yeah. And if you don't know Matt, shame on you. He's a really fun and intelligent film critic.
Yep.
You should check out his listicles, which he periodically comes up with. You know.
Yep.
He's a pretty snappy dresser, too. If you, he's very well groomed. Anyway, so
I'm sure he'll be happy to hear that.
He's a great bowler.
Really?
He drinks like a fish.
Well, don't we all?
Yes, well, yeah. That was my empty beer. But we'll have that. And we're also kicking around a bunch of other ideas for bringing on guests, like my roommate and friend Zach Miko, who is an expert in trauma films. And we'll be talking to him about the bottom of the barrel of trauma, because he's sort of an unofficial historian when it comes to this stuff, and he's good people to know when it comes to disreputable films, so we're going to have a fun time with that.
Mm-hmm.
But from there, you know, the sky's the limit. We want your feedback pretty badly. It's not just a matter of, like, oh, stroke our ego. Although, you know, if you would stroke our ego, it'd be awesome.
It'd be awesome.
Just leave some fucking comments.
But no, we do like to hear from you, and we like people to suggest,
give us ideas. Yeah. You know, like Matt Lynch has given us some good ones.
Yeah.
Give us some feedback, what you like, what you don't like. If it's get rid of the Jew.
We may not make it to this. We may not listen to that suggestion.
Yeah. Because I don't want to get rid of Steve. Oh, shit, I outed him.
No!
Anyway,
I'm wearing my yarmulke now.
Where's your yarmulke, Steve? So the point being that we're trying new stuff.
Do you think Claude Lanzmann would ask Jack and Gillette?
Oh, he totally. I think Claude Lanzmann would be so appalled at this movie.
His head would explode. His yarmulke would explode.
His yarmulke would do a loop-de-loop before exploding. But, fuck. So, yeah, what I was trying to say is we have another exciting, hopefully, many years ahead of us for this podcast, however long we stay with it. But for everyone that's been listening for a year, we really appreciate your patronage and your interest. We have a really good time doing it, and here's to another year.
Fuck yeah.
All right, and we'll hopefully see you next month in Philly.
Yeah. Bye!